I want to talk to you a little bit about the ministry of power to change. And because I really love the book of Jonah, it's a missiological text or a missions-minded text. I want to just kind of hit some highlights in that particular book. So if you'll allow me to do that, I would really enjoy doing that with you this morning. I live in Maple Ridge. I moved down there in 2010, and it's been a good experience so far. I don't know what else to tell you. My life wasn't really going anywhere. I had a Bible background and a Bible degree, and I wanted to use it. And I had some contacts here, but it just didn't seem like the doors were being opened. So God had opened the doors for me to get involved with some ministry down in Vancouver. So for this morning, just so you know, we have a few things, a few pictures I want to show you. Actually, some pictures from Israel. Talk to you a little bit about Jonah. This is a gentleman that I took a picture of in Liberia last year. Actually, the ministry that I work with, we plan on being back in Liberia in probably the next couple of months. So I may be going there within the next 6 months or something like that. We have a lot of churches there that we plant. The ministry that I work with, Power to Change, it used to be called Campus Crusade for Christ. And now they use the Jesus film. And there's some videos, by the way. I have a little thing set up in the back. You can sign up for my newsletter in case I forget to tell you. We're taking some of the teaching material that we've been writing. This is not our material that we've been writing, but we plant churches with this material. We show the Jesus film. We drill water wells. Got a video that's going to explain it in a little bit. It's really, really interesting. It's a fantastic model, and to be quite honest with you, I don't know of one ministry in the world that is doing what we're doing with drilling wells, showing the Jesus film, planting churches. We're planting about 250 churches around the world each year. Yeah. Sometimes when we go into a village, 60, 70% of a village will come to Christ. I'm not kidding you. This is a special book now that we're using for Muslims. I just got back from Tanzania last month. Muslims down there, generally speaking, on West Africa, they're pretty tame. On East Africa, you start to get into Somalia, close to Saudi Arabia. They're a bit more militant. No, not all like that, but we've been having a lot of pushback, a lot of grief with them. They've burnt some of the churches that we've planted, terrorized the pastor and his wife, burned the Bibles, burned the computer we bought them, pushed them all in the front of the lawn, lit them all on fire, and then we bought them a new laptop and some new Bibles and material and whatnot, and they came back and did it again. A true story here, and I'm going to move on, but one church that was burnt down, like three rebels, this is a true story, came from, it's in Africa somewhere, they came from another village, and then they came into the one of the villages where we had, you know, we raised support for the ministry, for the building the buildings and these kinds of things, and people like in churches or whatever, they helped to offset the costs. These fellas came from another village, and they burnt down the church, and they scared the pastor and his wife off, they ran away. And then when they came back, they rebuilt the church. They had enough material left over from some scrap material. They had another church service. And within 1 month, those three men, they were Muslim men, those three men that came from another village to burn this church down, and they did, they successfully burnt the church down. Within 1 month, all three of those men were dead. And I don't know how they died, but that's a fact. That's what's going on the field. So it's pretty exciting. It's really quite cutting-edge ministry. We do put ourselves a little bit of a risk when we go out in the field, but I've kind of always had that little bit of a streak in me. I would like to show you a little bit of what we do. It's a 2.5-minute video on Water for Life. It shows you a little bit about our well-drilling strategy, what we do with the Jesus film, our discipleship program, which I'll talk to you about. So if we could roll the video, that would be great.
Many people consider access to fresh drinking water a right. But for 884 million people, that's not a reality. They're drinking water that carries many diseases. And sadly, 3.5 million people die every year as a result. So what if we provided them with a deep cap water bottle? With this, 1,000 people gain access to fresh water for up to 25 years. A village released from the cycle of sickness and death. Women no longer have to carry water for hours a day. kids are free up to attend school, people have more time to work in their farms, and overall economic activity improves. But how does it work? Well, GAIN meets with the local government to determine areas desperate for clean water. From there, villages apply for a water well. Drill teams then provide a fully functioning well to those villages that are in need. Sustainability. Villagers pay a small fee for each bucket of water. These funds go into a village bank account that is used for both well repair and community projects, such as the construction of schools or vegetable gardens. Villages are also given additional opportunities to develop their communities through the borehole community training, which educates villagers about well maintenance and best water use practices. They also receive hygiene and sanitation training. Occasionally, villages will receive gender equality training, which teaches the community to value the roles of others. They also have the option to visit a medical and dental clinic, which treats illnesses caused by years of contaminated water. And there's more. With a gift of water comes the opportunity to discover living water through the Jesus Dome Church Planting Strategy. The Jesus Dome Church Planting Strategy team empowers a local church called the Mother Church to plant another church in a village where a well is just provided. The team trains the church members on how to nurture the new believers. The film is then shown in the new location, and other church members attend so they can do the follow-up. New believers are then brought together to form a new church with the challenge to reproduce themselves and plant another church in a new village. The Jesus Film Church Planning Strategy team then moves to another location to repeat this cycle. With their physical and spiritual needs now being met, villagers begin to experience significant transformation. God's love has been demonstrated in word and deed to hurting and needy people around the world.
Wow, so that's what we do. And we take that all over the world, and we travel, and we're in several countries, Syria, North Korea, Israel, Ethiopia, Tanzania. We're even in Iraq. We had a team that came back from Iraq, not too far from the Erbil area, right where ISIS is right now. Fantastic ministry going on right there in the camps with the people. So a lot of the Muslim people are there, and we're having opportunities to meet their needs. So that's kind of what we do, and we plant, like I said, we plant churches with the Jesus Film, and I'm responsible for the leadership development. I'm technically a writer. I'm not really much of a writer, but we work on a team, so that's what we do, and it's fantastic. So I want to talk to you a little bit about a missions-minded text today, which is one of my favorites. It's the book of Jonah. It's been read to you, the passage has been read to you. And we have a picture of actually a beach picture of Tel Aviv, which is a port not too far from where Jonah would have probably got on a ship. This is a picture of Tel Aviv looking, that's actually looking north, so that's Tel Aviv that way. And the port right where Jonah would have probably got on a ship was right around here somewhere. And the text is really quite interesting because God spoke to him and he told him to get up and go visit this capital of the Assyrian nation of the city of Nineveh, and he was a very disobedient character, which we're going to learn about. There's also a picture of a statue of a whale. It's about 100 meters or so from the water, and it's actually a water fountain. It's about 10 feet tall, 10 feet long. It's really interesting. If you're ever doubting the Bible, look at biblical archaeology. Look at the things that have happened around the world. I mean, the fact that there's a whale like this, picture like this, 100 feet from the water, it's telling you that something really happened. And also, there's some Egyptian ruins there that predate Jonah's existence or arrival in the city of Joppa, which is on the hill. The bay is down there, as you see, down by the water. So these Egyptian ruins predate Jonah's arrival by about 750 years. So folks, that means that if Jonah happened to be walking down the street, he would have seen this building right there. And those are the ruins of it. It's really, really amazing. And for those of you who have never been to Israel, you need to go. You really, if we go to Hawaii, we go to Mexico, you really, really need to go to Israel. When I was there for 10 days about 4 years ago, every day I had a tear in my eye. I mean, it was that impactful. I mean, it was really phenomenal. And I can tell you some great tours to go on if you'd like to go. So the Egyptian ruins there are very quite interesting because they had an ongoing trade alliance with Palestine at the time. The Egyptians were using the embalming salts and chemicals from the Dead Sea in their for embalming their pharaohs, which is the ongoing trade alliance that they had. A lot of people don't know that, but that's kind of what was happening. And so God called Jonah to go up and speak to the Assyrian nation. And it's really quite interesting, the text, why God called him to go up there. And he was very rebellious, and he didn't want to go, and for good reason. Many believe that the Assyrians were the ones that invented crucifixion about 750 BC. It wasn't the Romans, they simply refined it. So we have some pictures here. As you can see from here, you'll see, I didn't bring my laser pointer, but you have literally, you have men in the top left-hand corner, you have them impaled on stakes. Down here, you have body parts, you have heads and arms and legs, and they counted their dead by taking skulls and putting them in piles. I mean, they were really, really wicked, vile people. And by the way, that's probably 200 miles, where this was found, was probably within 200 miles of where ISIS is working today. And what are they doing? Same kinds of things. So God was telling Jonah to get up and go to these people and give them a message about my love and my restoration and that you can have a relationship with me. And all he wanted to do was get out of Dodge. So I want to take a look at that today. And the Hebrew text is very quite interesting. Of course, the Old Testament being written primarily in Hebrew, New Testament being written in Greek. The Old Testament, some portions of it are in Aramaic. Daniel 3:7 to 7:14 is in Aramaic, but generally speaking, it's in Hebrew. And the Hebrew text here in Jonah is very, very interesting. And I'd like to take a look at some of that and for our time this morning. So God spoke to the prophet Jonah and told him to go to Nineveh. And what did he do? He told him to get up and go in chapter 1, verse 1. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai, saying, "Go, arise, go to Nineveh and cry out against this city, for their wickedness has come up before me," or literally before my face or in my nostrils is what it's talking about, because it's the Hebrew here is very very rich in its definition, in its fullness. Now the background of the city, before I want to talk about the text, is it was really Nineveh itself. It was founded about 750 BC. Approximately 120,000 people were there. It encompassed about 1,800 acres. Now it's interesting, the founder of Nineveh was a fellow named Nimrod. Nimrod was the fellow who built the Tower of Babel. And his name, Nimrod, comes from a Hebrew word, marad, which means rebel. So Nimrod, think about it this way. Nimrod, his name means rebel, went to the capital of the Assyrian nation and was the founder of the city of Nineveh. His name means rebel, and he's also the builder of the Tower of Babel, which means confusion. So you know, you have a guy who's a rebel, builds a tower, means confusion. Interesting, Jonah's father, actually Jonah's name in Hebrew means dove, but his father, Amittai, means faithful. This is interesting family dynamics here. He was also the great-grandson of Noah. So you have great-grandson of Noah, something fell through the cracks. Jonah is really starting to go sideways here. Interestingly enough, the city of Nineveh, they worshiped one of the Babylonian sea gods, Ishtar. So think about it this way, if you know this biblical story, when Jonah eventually shows up in the city, he shows up and some historians feel that his skin may have been partially bleached from the gastric juices from the whale, may have been partially blind, we don't know. But essentially, he shows up and he says, "My God is greater than your God," because he tells them the story of his trip in the whale. So this is where crucifixion was invented. People were impaled. It was a hotbed for cults and religion that was just really, really traumatic on the people. So I'd like to take a look at our text here this morning. God spoke to him, and the word of the Lord came to Jonah to go and arise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and call out against it, or to cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. Now the text is really interesting there. It gives you the idea in the Hebrew text that this is a smoldering fire. It doesn't just give the idea that, well, I know what's going on. The idea is that the sin of the people has come up literally before my nostrils, is what God is saying. It's like a smoldering campfire. You know, God sees what's going on. He knows of the wickedness of these people, and he sees it, and he knows what's going on. So it's actually the sin of the people, the things that they've been doing, has come up literally before my presence, and I'm quite aware of it, is what he's telling Jonah. And he tells him to go immediately. It's imperative that you go. It's like saying, I'm going to Hawaii. That's not really what it means. What I'm saying is, I'm really, really, really going to Hawaii. Like, it's imperative that you're going to Hawaii. You're not just going to Hawaii. It's really, really imperative that I've got to get a holiday. I'm going to Hawaii. And that's what God's saying here. You have to go. It's an imperative, forceful command. And Jonah's really dragging his feet. But instead of getting up and going about 500 miles east to Nineveh, what does he do? He gets up and he goes down to Joppa. God tells him to get up and go. He gets up and goes down to Joppa. Now we believe at this time he was probably in Jerusalem because he goes down to Joppa. Joppa's on the coast. Jerusalem is up on a hill. It's about 74 kilometers away. It takes you about 40 minutes to drive by car. So he gets down to Joppa. And he starts to look around for a few things. And he chose to go to Joppa because, generally speaking, Joppa at that time was not under Jewish command. It was under Gentile or non-Jewish command, the people that were in the city. So automatically, he's already running from God simply because he's going to Joppa. And then the text is very interesting. But Jonah arose to flee to go to Tarshish, which is in the southern part of Spain, but they believe. And to this day, in the synagogue, the Jewish synagogues in Tarshish, in the southern part of Spain, they still sing a song in Hebrew about the prophet Jonah coming to Spain, or wanting to come to Spain, to this day. I talked to a Jewish man in New York about this text, and he said, yep, he doesn't really believe in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. If you're talking to a Jewish person, don't use the word Old Testament, it offends them. Talk to him about the Hebrew Bible, you'll at least have a listening ear. He says, to this day, we still sing a song about Jonah coming, wanting to come to the southern part of Spain. But Jonah fled from Tarshish, to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord, and he went down to Joppa, and he found a ship. That word found is very, very interesting in the text. He just didn't walk down the beach and said, hey, you know, where are you guys going? The word that's used, the Hebrew word that's used for found there, is he was seeking out something very, very specific. He was looking for, he was already in a non-Gentile area. He wanted to get away from religious people. He wanted to go to an unbelieving portion of the coastal city. He went down there and he sought out a ship that was going to Tarshish. And at that time, that was the furthest point away from where he was, which is on the eastern Mediterranean. It was the furthest point away. It's almost, you know, up by France, you know, Spain, a long way away. He sought a ship going there, specifically looking for something to get away from what God was calling him to do. So then he paid the fare, negotiated the price with the ship owner. Now, it doesn't say this in the Bible, but according to Jewish tradition, the fare that Jonah paid was so great. You've got to remember, this is a guy who's running from God. He wants to get out of Dodge. It's probably a two-day trek to get from Jerusalem to Joppa. He's tired. He's running. He doesn't want to do what God wants him to do. He specifically sought a ship that was going that way. God wanted him to go that way. He wants to go 2,200 miles the other way. He's running. So he paid the fare, but according to Jewish tradition, the fare that he paid was so great that he bought the entire ship. That's Jewish tradition. It's not in the Bible, but that's sort of what they talk about. By the way, the stormy season in Tel Aviv on that portion of the coast has been January and February. May or may not have happened then, we don't really know. but it's quite interesting that that's traditionally the stormy sea season time of the year. So he actively sought a ship, went to the Gentile portion of the coast, and it's interesting that when he gets out on the sea, some really interesting things happen to him. Let's take a look at verse 4. And then God sent out a great wind on the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, that the ship was about to be broken up. The Hebrew text is quite interesting. We studied this in seminary. The ship, the idea that when the ship was about to be broken up, it brings across the idea in the Hebrew text, the ship is thinking itself on which part to let go. It's not that that's even practical because it's an inanimate object, but that's kind of the imagery that comes across. The ship is discussing with itself which part's going to fly apart because something's going to fly apart. That's kind of the idea that it has here. So God sent out and caused a great wind upon the sea. Now it's really interesting that God caused the wind to come upon the sea in a divine appointment because Jonah was being disobedient, running from God. But it's also really interesting that it says that God, really in the Hebrew text, God hurled the wind at the ship. And it's like a big league pitcher standing on a pitching mound. I live in Vancouver, or Maple Ridge, so the odd time we travel down to a Mariners game and there's this big mound of dirt. I don't know much about baseball, but there's this big mound of dirt. And these guys wind up and they throw fastballs, 95, 100 miles an hour. And that's what's going on here. God hurled this great wind at the ship. And it's interesting because the storm it's getting bigger and it's getting bigger and bigger. And actually, it talks about the storm growing, but the idea is the waves are walking upon waves. Really what it means in the original language is this waves upon waves. The further that they ran from God, the worse the storm got. So in verse 5, you now see the sailors, the mariners. Now they were afraid, and every man cried out to his own God, and the cargo that was in the ship that they threw into the ship to lighten the load. Now they were calling out to their own God, which I find is really, really interesting, because later on in the text, they're calling out to the Lord. So here, in verse 5, they're calling out to their gods, their little pagan gods. And then later on, they start calling out to the Lord. So there's three kinds of storms in our lives. Generally, the storms that we go through every day, you know, you get up to go to work, the tire's flat on the car, the dog gets sick, the truck won't start. There's storms of correction, and there's storms of direction. When we're seeking guidance and direction from God, He sometimes guide you and direct you through storms in your own life. Maybe it may be a health issue. It might be a financial struggle. It doesn't mean that God's abandoned you. It just means that He's thinking about guiding and directing your life. There's also storms of correction. And I think, personally, I think that Jonah was going through a storm of correction as well as redirection. And that's what happens when we get out of line. God does correct us. So in chapter 3, verse 3, we start to see what's happening. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and preach against it, that I tell you." So now, listen to this. So Jonah rose and went to Nineveh, according to the word of the Lord. Now Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, a three-day journey in extent. And Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk, and he cried out and said, "Yet 40 days, and Nineveh shall be overthrown." Do you see what's going on here? It's 3 days to cover the entire area, to tell everybody about the message of God's destruction. 3 days. To cover, to canvass everybody. Jonah goes 1 day. He goes 1 day and tells them the message that he should be telling them after 3 days. He's still, after what he's been through, I can't cover all the story. Some of you know the story about him being swept overboard and being swallowed by the whale. We don't have time to get into it. But the idea is he's disobedient and he still has a bad attitude. But God's getting his attention. Chapter 4, and this displeased Jonah exceedingly because God had spared the city. He became angry. Therefore I had previously fled to Tarshish, for I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. And that's Jonah speaking to God. And then it actually in verse 4, chapter 4, verse 9. Then God spoke to Jonah, "Is it right for you to be angry about the plant?" Because there was a plant that grew. To give Jonah some shade as he was watching whether or not, after he proclaimed the message to the city, whether the city was going to be destroyed. And Jonah was angry at the plant because the plant had grown up and given him shade. And the plant had died. And actually, he's so angry here. It's anger upon anger. Anger is really how it comes across in the original language. And to be quite frank with you, it's almost brings across the same force as an expletive in the original language. It's only found one or two times in Scripture. And that's really what was going on in Jonah's life. And I found for, you know, many years, even in my own life, I felt the same way. That I wasn't really interested in kind of what went on there. I had my own life. I was a tradesman. I'm a millwright and a machinist by my trade and that I did for many years. But I found that, in just pursuing things and money and stuff, I was never fulfilled and content inside. And, you know, God is seeking a relationship with his people. And I don't know most of you here, but you need to know something, that God has designed us, specifically designed us, for a personal relationship with him. And that's what Jonah was being used by God to go and tell the people, that God had a plan and a purpose for your life. There's a judgment coming on your life because of your sin, but I'm also providing a way of escape. And he's doing the same thing today and has done the same thing today. So I just want to explain to you something about how you can have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. You might be trying to find your significance or your security in money or things, maybe a relationship out of marriage or whatever it might be. You name the list. And you'll never, never find peace and joy and contentment in this life. You'll never find it because you were hardwired for a relationship with God. And that's just the way it is. I met a multi-millionaire one time in Florida, and we were standing on the Gulf. I don't know how I met this fellow. Well, through some friends, Jewish man. And he said, "Religion, man," he said, "you don't want to do that with your life." He was an older gentleman, 83. He'd fought in the Second World War and had a lot of stories. And he was just, you know, he was a very hardened man. And I put my arm around him. I said, "Dan, you know, when it comes time to leave this world, it all stays behind." And he put his head down and he said, "Yeah, you're right." So I want you to know today that God is seeking a relationship with you. And if you don't know what it is to have a relationship with Christ, to have your sins forgiven, that you can do that today. You can have a personal relationship with God, and you can have a relationship with Jesus Christ, because God sent him to die on a cross to take your payment for your sin, what you deserve, what you earned, he's going to take for you. Your responsibility is to accept that free gift. And it's a free gift. God won't push himself into your life. It's a free gift. And that's the message that we take all over the world. And it's the message that we at Power to Change take very seriously. Sometimes 60, 70% of a village will respond to that message. And we have film guys that live in the villages. We disciple people. I travel a little bit, and I'll be traveling even more this year. And it's a good thing, because we're discipling the people that we're leading to Christ. And they're hungry. They're begging us. My newsletter's on a table out there. I'd like you to sign up for my newsletter if you want to know more about what we're doing. I'm still raising support and things. If you'd like to become involved with me as a ministry partner, that's great. But you need to know that your primary responsibility here is for this church and for the missions programs that you have here. You need to continue to do that. And I don't want to rob anybody's donations to anything that they're doing here, but it's very, very important that you support this ministry, because I'm nobody special, but I came through here because people like you gave through the years, because you believed in this church and this ministry. And so I just want to thank you for that, and I thank you for really pouring your lives into me. I used to run up and down these aisles, and this church has a lot of fond memories. The stage is much different. And I'd love to talk to you a little bit more if you're interested in the relationship part of Jesus Christ that I spoke to you about. If you don't know much about that, if you're interested in that, come see me, talk to me afterwards. Pastor Dan. Pastor Dan, thank you so much for having me here. It's been wonderful to be here. It's a privilege to be here. And the Rolex never stopped, so that's good. So my time is done. I'm thankful that you allowed me to be here. And please stop by the table. And remember the story of Jonah, the disobedient servant, and what happened in his life. Be obedient. If God calls you to get involved,